What are you deciding when you decide to carry a firearm outside your home? From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Thursday, April 22nd, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, SDPB's Spotlight on Guns in South Dakota. We talk with an NRA certified firearms instructor about enhanced carry permits, being responsible for every bullet, and the protections of state law and the Second Amendment. We talk about collaborative health care for rural communities. Steve Long joins us after today's Morning Phillip gathering in Rapid City. Jackie Hendry brings environmental reporting for this Earth Day ahead of tonight's South Dakota Focus. Plus, it's time to get your hands into the soil. Our South Dakota Home Garden segment returns. That's coming later in the hour. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. Governor Kristi Noem says a new executive order bans government-issued COVID-19 vaccine passports. The passports provide documentation for people looking to enter venues or travel internationally. Noem says the idea is un-American and would limit personal freedoms. South Dakota joins a handful of states, including Texas and Florida, that prohibit state agencies from mandating proof of vaccinations. More than half of South Dakotans have received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. Congressman Dusty Johnson wants to remove more damaged timber from national forests after wildfires. The South Dakota Republican is addressing the issue with new legislation. The bill requires the Forest Service to make damaged trees available for logging within 60 days after a fire. The bill also relaxes environmental reviews for logging hazardous trees within 200 feet of a road. And it makes lawsuits less likely to stop either activity.
This is something that is, I think, going to be very important to the Black Hills as well as all national forests. This streamlines the ability of the timber industry and the Forest Service to get dead timber out of the forest.
Johnson acknowledges the bill lacks Democratic support. Scientists say there are reasons to leave some dead timber in the forest. The organic material feeds the soil as it breaks down, while some birds and animals make their homes in dead trees. The state's largest community is looking to change by upgrading its parks over the next year. The Sioux Falls Parks and Recreation Director spoke with area business leaders searching for their support. SDPB's Jordan Henderson reports.
2020 was a rough year for Parks and Rec Department in Sioux Falls. Director Don Kearney says they had to make changes on the fly just to keep the parks clean.
We work all winter long gearing up for the summer season, only to have the plug pulled, essentially. Obviously, you don't have seasonal employees, you don't have pools open. That changes things a lot. And so we brought in people from the parking division. We brought in people from libraries because libraries are closed, put them on mowers, string trimmers. We had all kinds of people working everywhere across our park system.
Kearney says those plans include a $4 million park with an ice ribbon and an all-inclusive playground, along with the Downtown River Greenway Phase 3, a redesign of Falls Park, and many more. The Jacobson Plaza at Falls Park will include an ice ribbon for ice skating and an all-inclusive playground thanks to a donation from business owners Gary and Diane Jacobson. The Downtown River Greenway is a riverwalk-like trail that runs between Falls Park and Fowick Park on both sides of the river running through the downtown area. The Greenway will be part of the Sioux Steel Development Area. A competition for the redesign is currently underway, according to Kearney. Six different firms across the country have submitted proposals for a redesign of Falls Park. Kearney says the infrastructure has been outgrown and a change is needed in order to keep the park for years to come. Kearney asked for the community to help by spreading the word and supporting the Parks and Rec Department any way they can.
The things that we're trying to do is tell our story, and that means you helping us to tell our story. Hopefully you've gotten some good information, but also get involved. You know, there are lots of groups out there that we partner with that help support Parks and Recreation.
Other improvements include the Cherry Creek Trail leading to the bike path, a lion exhibit at the Great Plains Zoo, a new ski lift at Great Bear, and a new clubhouse at the Elmwood Golf Course. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Jordan Henderson.
For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Lori Walsh. The Schroeder fire started March 29th, just west of Rapid City, and it burned for more than a week, fueled by strong winds and dry conditions. It destroyed at least one home and caused the temporary evacuation of about 500 people. SDPB's Seth Tupper joins us now from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio inside SDPB's Black Hills studio with an update. Seth, welcome.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me.
I understand we have a new report about the fire and how it began. Tell us a little bit about this stage of the investigation.
Yeah, so on Tuesday, the State Department of Public Safety and other state officials released a news release identifying the cause of the fire. They said it was what's called a slash pile that a homeowner had intentionally burned. Slash pile is a term for a big pile of branches and twigs and leaves and just, you know, forest debris that's been mm-hmm. piled up to be burned. And that basically embers from that slash pile after it was extinguished are what caused the fire. And besides the press release, they also made clear that the full investigative report was available. So I requested that. And that is a 68-page report with some more details.
Yeah. As you go through that report, what are some of the things that you found that might not have made the initial headlines?
Right. And so we had to dig a little deeper to get some more information beyond the news release. And so really what the scenario that's laid out here is that this homeowner just west of Rapid City in a hilly kind of partial forest, partial grassland area, moved in late 2019, early 2020. He got a permit for this to burn this slash pile in January, and that permit was good through March 30th. So a couple of weeks before the wildfire, the homeowner actually ignited this pile while there was snow on the ground, and it burned for about a week. And he, from what he told investigators, took great pains to make sure that this fire was completely out. It burned all the way to the ground. They worked the soil over with machinery to try to put out all the embers, and he was apparently quite sure that this fire was extinguished. But investigators say that they ruled out lightning, they ruled out cigarettes, they ruled out everything else except for the possibility that there were embers left over from this burn pile from about a week prior, that when the wind kicked up on March 29th and winds gusted from 40 to 70 miles per hour, investigators say that, you know, the likely cause of this fire was some kind of leftover ember from that pile that escaped and was windblown and caused the wildfire.
Tell us what you learned about the pile itself, the debris that was being burned. It's related to another incident in the Black Hills.
And that is the great irony tucked into the middle of this report. Apparently, the bulk of the debris in that pile was from the 1988 Westbury Trails fire. And if you look on Google Earth, you can see there's still a very large scar just west of Rapid City where there's not many trees, where the Westbury Trails fire burned a big area in 1988. Some of that downed timber and trees and branches had apparently was still there and had been gathered up and piled in this pile. And that was the material that investigators say led to this new wildfire. That burned another 2,000 acres.
Yeah. So this homeowner moved in when, did you say, 2020?
According to the investigative report, late 2019 or early 2020.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So whoever was there before some of this debris from 1988, is it common for debris like that to wait around this many, 30 years, something like, in waiting to be dealt with, or is that extraordinary in and of itself?
I don't know if it's common. You know, in the Black Hills, yeah, slash piles are common. If you pay attention, right, as you drive around, you see these big piles of trees and branches and other debris that maybe have been piled up from after a logging project or something. And generally, you know, the Forest Service or other people, if it's private property, they wait for there to be snow on the ground to burn these things safely. So I would say, you know, from what I've heard or learned, they usually don't last that long. But of course, when you have a fire as big as the Westbury Trails fire, it can take decades, you know, for to recover from that, and for the land to recover, and for people to recover. So mm-hmm. in this case, that's what they're saying.
So the homeowner had that permit to build to burn the slash pile, and no charges have been filed at this point. What happens next now that we have this report, Seth? Is there more to the story in the days ahead, or is this the end of this story?
We'll have to wait and see. Authorities said there are no charges filed at this time. I don't know if they added that phrase at this time because there may be, or that was just the way that they wrote it. Mm-hmm. But there's no criminal charges filed right now. Of course, you know, we'll have to wait and see if anybody would file any litigation over this. It was somebody else's home who was destroyed, not the person who ignited the slash pile. And there were some other buildings damaged by this fire. Lots of people had their lives disrupted. 500 people, you know, temporarily evacuated. So we'll wait and see if there's any charges filed or if there's any litigation that arises out of this.
SDPB's Seth Tupper joining us from the SDPB studios in the Black Hills. Thanks, Seth. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Today is Earth Day. The first Earth Day was in 1970. Up ahead on In the Moment, we talk to Jackie Hendry about tonight's South Dakota Focus. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
The vaccine rollout is going strong, but one epidemiologist says we still need a backup plan. Now, enter lower-cost at-home COVID tests, which are finally available without a prescription.
These are our eyes to be able to see where the virus is and whether we're at a risk of spreading it to people.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, at-home COVID testing this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. First Dakota National Bank celebrates individuals and businesses with a passion to turn their dreams into South Dakota firsts. Learn more at firstdakota.com/first.
I'm Jackie Hendry, host of South Dakota Focus. A recent USDA Forest Service report calls for decreased timber production in the Black Hills, and one sawmill has already closed. U.S. Congressman Dusty Johnson weighs in. Dr. David O'Hara shows how environmental studies students are changing the landscape of Augustana University. Plus, the next installment of our series, Good Neighbors. That's Thursday night at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on SDPB-TV.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Cultural Heritage Center in Pierre. The museum now offers free admission to South Dakota residents and children from everywhere. Coronavirus protections in place. More at 773-3458 or history.sd.gov.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. The world's first Earth Day was on this day in 1970. It's a day that is internationally recognized as the awakening of both an environmental consciousness in America and a political movement, one that looked at the pollution and ecosystem degradation of the 70s and imagined a cleaner, regenerative future. Well, tonight, South Dakota Focus explores a variety of environmental issues in South Dakota. Jackie Hendry hosts the program tonight on SDPB-TV, and she's joining us now with a preview from our studios in Vermilion. Jackie, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Happy Earth Day.
Happy Earth Day. And tell us a little bit about this show, because Earth Day is celebrated around the world, but this is a very specific South Dakota focus.
Yes, it is. And it's very exciting that we're able to focus the entire hour on environment-related topics on our show this evening. And to be honest with you, I still ran out of room for all the possible stories that we could have told on this Earth Day show. But we're going to start out with Seth Tupper has done a really excellent report on the recent Black Hills National Forest report, the Forest Service calling for a significant decrease in timber production. So that's where we're going to spend a lot of our time this evening. We'll hear from Congressman Dusty Johnson, and then we'll also hear from the state forester Greg Jostin and Bob Burns of the Norbeck Society, really weighing possible solutions to this issue, which way is the timber industry going to go. And I've really learned a lot through this reporting, and we're going to learn a lot more this evening, too.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about who is on the show tonight and who you've spoken to and what some of the just hints of what they have to say.
Right. So yesterday I recorded an interview with Congressman Dusty Johnson. Since the fire that we just heard about, mm-hmm. since the Forest Service report, he was out west talking with a variety of stakeholders, timber professionals, including some who've lost their jobs with the closing of the Hill City sawmill, environmentalists, and so on. Here's a clip of part of that conversation. He says Everyone he's talked to has the same goal of protecting and not over-harvesting the Black Hills National Forest.
I think we know this is the goose that every single year lays the golden egg of an incredibly special place, for many a sacred place. We want to protect that. I think we can do that while also making sure that we allow for a strong timber industry. And here's why that's important. We know that in other states where they have lost that timber industry, their forests have gotten sick because they have not had the dedicated professionals who have been able to go out and thin that forest. A thinning forest allows for trees to grow more quickly, meaning that they absorb more carbon. It means that fire danger is lower and not as intense. A managed forest is absolutely a better forest.
Congressman Dusty Johnson there. My guest is Jackie Hendry. And we're talking about tonight's Earth Day South Dakota Focus. Tell me more about Congressman Johnson and the big picture of what he's trying to do here.
Well, he's recently introduced what he's calling the FIRE Act. FIRE stands for the Forestry Improvements to Restore the Environment Act. And it's very specifically targeted to issues like we're seeing with the Black Hills National Forest. This act would require the Forest Service to survey any land under their purview that's impacted by a wildfire within 60 days of containment. It establishes, it streamlines regulations for salvaging trees within 200 feet of roadways and establishes some judicial review processes so you don't have to wait, say, for a court case to be wrapped up before you can start gathering up this timber. So that's part of his kind of big picture potential solution to some of the issues that we're hearing. And he's also hoping to establish some uses for timber that from trees that might not be large enough for traditional uses from timber production, but could instead be used to build things like chairs and desks and things like that. So instead of just rotting on the forest floor, we have some products that can also sustain the industry.
Right, and he's coming at this with a we can all work together. You know, everyone's best interests are the same here. How are his efforts really landing with other people? How is he seen from outside the conversation looking in?
Well, he's admitted that this particular act doesn't seem to have much in the way of Democratic support in Congress, which I found interesting, and he'll expand on that just a little bit in our conversation this evening. I'm really looking forward to asking in our live conversation the state forester, Greg Jostin, and Bob Burns with the Norbeck Society, kind of their mm-hmm. thoughts on this act, because they were part of a local work group dealing with a draft of that Forest Service report. They came down on kind of two different sides of the issue. Bob Burns agrees with the Forest Service. We need to significantly reduce timber production, whereas the state forester says, if anything, maybe we need to increase timber production. So I'll be interested to hear how they see this FIRE Act as bringing any solutions.
Right. Meanwhile, let's look to the future and some of the South Dakotans who today are in college and up and coming into an industry trying to figure out how to see the world. You talked with David O'Hara, who is part of Augustana University's Environmental Studies major. Tell me about that conversation, please.
I love that conversation. If you follow me on Twitter, you saw I was struggling this week bringing a 20-minute interview down to 5 minutes. This would be that conversation.
Yeah.
But what I love about Dr. O'Hara discussing this idea of when you study things like environmental philosophy, what you're really thinking about is he brings it down to balancing the three Ps: people, planet, and profit. And if you only focus on one of those three, something else is going to give. So he talks about how his students really seem to enjoy that kind of problem-solving aspect of considering how to best benefit all three of those priorities. And they do that in some ways. We talk about the outdoor classroom that students designed and helped construct on the Augustana campus, planting a prairie grass garden and apple orchards on campus, and doing other practical projects that apply something that, when you hear an environmental philosophy class exists, you're like, what am I going to do with that? Well, he explains, you're going to find ways to help people. and he refers to it as learning how to be a good ancestor.
Yeah. All right. And solve some really complicated problems. Good ancestors to good neighbors. You've got this great feature called Good Neighbors. Who's the good neighbor this week?
This week, we're celebrating Michelle Hawkes. She's the director of the Market and Garden with the Sichangu CDC's Food Sovereignty Initiative that's on the Rosebud Reservation. They have a really interesting, I visited this garden a few years ago, kind of a community-based garden where they grow and distribute fresh produce throughout the Rosebud Reservation. So in some communities, you might have to drive 30 miles to get to the nearest grocery store, and that might not even be locally grown produce. Michelle is a big part of developing farmers markets, kind of produce subscription boxes that you can get throughout the reservation. And she has a really lovely bit of this interview where she talks about how much she loves working in the garden.
That connection, the reconnection, I guess, with the land, and just the sunshine, the way the dirt smells, just eating them vegetables that you grew, cooking them, feeding your family. It's a real connection to your own food. I really like gardening. It's really relaxing and it's fulfilling.
Well, we are going to have more on getting your hands in the roots of plants, especially bare root plants, a little bit later this hour with South Dakota Home and Garden. So it must be spring in South Dakota. You can tune in tonight to South Dakota Focus with Jackie Hendry. That's at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on SDPB TV 1. Jackie, thanks for being here. Have a great show.
Thanks, Lori. Thanks for having me.
Ahead on In the Moment, we're going to continue our SDPB Spotlight on guns in South Dakota. We talk with an NRA certified firearms instructor about being responsible for every bullet. You're on listener supported SDPB Radio.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. President Biden is promising to end the war in Afghanistan.
I'm now the fourth United States president preside over American troop presence in Afghanistan. Two Republicans, two Democrats. I will not pass this responsibility onto a fifth.
What does a veteran of that war think? That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding with your support and by McCrory Gardens in Brookings, planting over 40,000 flowers every spring. More information at McCrorygardens.com. McCrory Gardens, ready to bloom.
On the next Fresh Air, taking on racial bias and law enforcement one department at a time, we speak with Philip Atiba Goff, co-founder of the Center for Policing Equity, about working with local police departments on strategies to reduce racial disparities in car stops, searches, and the use of force. Join us.
This afternoon at 2, 1 Mountain on SDPB.
Join your friends and neighbors who keep SDPB strong, become a $5 a month sustaining member, and gain access to a library of hundreds of shows with SDPB Passport. Details at sdpb.org/passport.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. SDPB's spotlight for April is guns in South Dakota. We're talking about the policies and politics, rights and responsibilities, history and heritage. You can find all our coverage on our website at sdpb.org/spotlight. Today we're talking with Matt Schluter. He is owner of Schluter Firearms Instruction. He helps train South Dakotans in safety and marksmanship, and he has seen an increase in business as more people want to qualify for an enhanced carry permit, which allows them to take concealed firearms into other designated states. We begin when I asked Matt Schluter about his earliest memory of handling a gun.
I was seven.
Seven.
Yeah. Welcome to America. My dad hauled me to the, my dad made me go to the city dump with him to help unload his F-100 pickup. We get done unloading and we're at the city dump. I grew up in a really small town and he looks at me and he goes, "Oh, look, the city bar dumped all their bottles." And I was like, "Oh," and he goes, "Go pick up those bottles and put them on that tree stump." And by the time I get done, I mean, I'm 7 years old. I really didn't realize what he had planned. He had pulled out a single action Ruger 22 caliber pistol. And he goes, "Well, it's probably time you learn how to shoot."
Wow. And you had no idea that was coming.
No, we didn't use eye protection. We didn't use ear protection. I mean, my dad had his own way of teaching, probably not to the what everyone would consider, you know, the NRA standard, yeah, for instruction, but you know, it was all there. Keep your finger off the trigger, keep the gun pointed in a safe direction. This is how it works. Guns are dangerous. And of course he demonstrated that by then sending me out to fill bottles full of water. But anyways, in a road ditch, you know, so you could watch them explode.
Right.
But, you know, to a little kid, these things are important, yeah, but you don't see a lot of that today.
Yeah. Was it cool, scary, exciting? What were some of the emotions? Exciting. What did you like about it? Because what I'm trying to get at, is it the bottle and the explosion, or is it the connection with your dad?
I think it's a little of both.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you got to realize I grew up in the 70s and the 80s. Mm-hmm. The world was a different place. Watching a Saturday rerun of John Wayne with my dad was actually a normal thing. Mm-hmm. You know, where you're watching TV shows where guns are involved heavily. You know, nowadays, depending on the family, you may or may not find that.
Yeah. Let's talk more about that, because there is this sense, you know, as we do this project on South Dakota Public Broadcasting, we're hearing all these stories, and many of them are rural, which makes the conversations we have about guns just as serious as anywhere else in the country. And we're just as worried about accidental deaths and homicides and mass shootings as anybody would be anywhere. But our formative mm-hmm. memories are often of something such as hunting or target shooting. What, in your capacity that you work in now, are you learning about nationwide what's happening to these skills and this knowledge of firearms in our country? How has it changed?
So from my youth, having grown up in my school system, I was attending in elementary and secondary school for middle school and high school. I mean, if your kid back then came to school and told the story to the teacher about doing what I did with my dad at the dump on Saturday,
right,
nobody got excited. And they'd be like, oh, did you have fun? And I go, yeah. And they go, so what kind of gun was it? And I'd describe it like something out of a John Wayne movie, which it was. And they go, oh, okay. And that was pretty much the end of it. If I had a 7-year-old, which my kids are way older now, went to elementary school and started to tell the same story, you may not get the same reaction from your local teachers. Because the acceptance of firearms is dwindling. And I think some of the perceptions are skewed. And I don't think that's correct that they are being skewed in that way.
Have you seen an uptick in people wanting to come to your classes for enhanced permit to carry or other training that you offer? How's business?
Yeah, it got crazy. We had, in a normal year, we run about 350 to 400 students on average. We exceeded 500 by quite a bit last year. And the interest isn't going away. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately. Well, I mean, for me, it's a business thing, but also, you know, you're relaying safety information. When you talk about personal safety, it goes way beyond just learning how to shoot.
Yeah.
So you're talking to people about how to be aware of their surroundings, things they can do in their home and their personal lives to keep themselves safe. Because the truth is, sometimes we're places where we can't carry guns. Mm-hmm. And when you're in one of those places, say like a school, you need to have the skills to realize if you hear something that sounds like gunshots, it's time to do something, whether it be lock the door and stay in a safe room or flee the area, whichever would be appropriate. But now is the time to do it, because if you're trying to wait and make that decision, you're only reducing the amount of time you have to try to react before something happens to you. Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you this, because most business owners, you know, if business is up that much, will say, you know, this is a great thing. And what I'm hearing you say, tell me if I'm hearing it correctly, is that it concerns you a little bit because it means more people are afraid. What is your, yeah. Okay. Tell me more about that.
You know, a lot of our students, I have three different categories of students. So So I have people like myself who had been in law enforcement, you know, got out of law enforcement, and now they decide they want their permit for whatever reason, you know, and maybe they carried concealed while they were on duty for the agency, or if they were in the military or for whatever job they had. But now they've decided, because something happened to them or in their community, that they feel the need to have the ability to carry concealed for personal protection again. And that involves also returning shooters, you know, avid sportsmen who normally in the past would have never considered guns being carried on their person as part of their daily routine. Then you have new shooters, and they're a different story. A lot of them, because some of them get the permit because somebody else in their family already carries concealed. Others had something happen to them, either directly, indirectly, or in their community. You know, here in Sioux Falls, if you watch the news, it doesn't take long to pick something out and go, oh, that happened over on such and such side of town. Mm-hmm. Well, somebody lives on that side of town, and some people may decide they need to start taking up either martial arts classes or other self-defense classes such as ours as part of their preparatory plan in case something ever happened to them.
Yeah. Matt, I want to talk to you about some basic gun safety things, because we just don't do that nearly enough. But first, I want to get at this idea that I've spent a lot of time thinking about, and I bet you have too, and that is just when you carry, you have decisions to make. You have decisions to make about how to protect yourself in a way that is safe. You have to be willing to take action, and you have to think deeply, and you have to think deeply about what you are willing to do and what you're not willing to do. How do you help people process some, because in some sense it's simple to make a decision to, you know, take things into your own hands. And then when the situation is upon you, you better have thought some things through before it happens. Walk me through some of that.
So some of the tools we talk about in our class would be the same thing your ex-husband would, or I would have experienced in law enforcement, where we talk about means, opportunity, and jeopardy. But it goes way beyond that, because you have to realize, what if you made a mistake? And you really have to keep that in mind when you're putting your personal protection plan together. When I first got into law enforcement, they'd do the interview, and I'm sure they did in the military too. They'd say, could you use deadly force? Everybody right. says yes.
Right.
But the truth is, not everybody can. And the reason everybody says yes is because that's what's expected of them. Mm-hmm. But what we think about and what we talk about in class involves, well, what if? What if you were wrong? Because ultimately, you'd be responsible for that decision. And some of the things that could be an honest mistake may not actually be an honest mistake in the middle of an incident. So let's say you're shooting at the bad guy in a justifiable shooting, and the bullet passes through the bad guy or you miss. Well, you're responsible for that round.
Mm-hmm.
So if I hit something, meaning property, I'm responsible for it. If I hit a person, which is a lot bigger problem, because now we're not only talking about civil liability, we're probably talking about criminal liability on top of that. And this is something, you know, concealed carry holders have to think about, you know, and they have to come up with these plans that we talk about in class.
We have talked a lot about responsibility, and I want to ask you about rights. And when we do look at, you know, efforts to curtail those rights, you know, people who are listening and say, wow, nobody should be allowed to have these things. Let's just get them off the streets. You would respond, what?
So I obviously like shooting. Mm-hmm. And I grew up around guns. I use guns. I hunt with guns. My favorite type of hunting, believe it or not, is black powder hunting for deer with a muzzleloader in our state. They give me a really long season to do it with. And it's more challenging because you only get one shot typically. That being said, I have hunted deer with an AR-15. I like shooting them. They're fun to shoot. They have a place. My wife hunts when we rifle hunts with our rifle tags in South Dakota. We both use an AR-15 based rifle, you know, so I don't think you can classify a tool as being bad. You really have to concentrate on it. It's the actions by the person using it. If we're to talk about criminal behavior, if a criminal used a rock to kill somebody, we're not going to ban all rocks. And if the criminal went out and got drunk and drove through a crowd of people at an open air event, like a spring or summer concert venue, we're not going to ban all the cars. You know, because obviously these people had issues. First, to be in the frame of mind to commit a violent act against other people, whether it be with your hands, feet, or a weapon of some type, I don't know how you get there. But, you know, we got to hold those people responsible for how they made that choice and making that choice.
Let me ask you this then, because the response for people who hear this are going to be, well, you can, you know, use a car to get to work and you can use a rock to, you know, build a building, but you can't use a gun to do those things. It's pretty much designed, you know, to fire, a round at a target. And having been a law enforcement officer and seen people at their worst days, do you have thoughts on how our society needs to address some of those problems that push people to criminal behavior or self-destructive behavior? Well, they will grab a tool, whether it be a rock or a car or a handgun or an AR-15, and they will take some kind of destructive action. I know that's a big question for, you know, one law enforcement officer to answer, but surely with your career, you have some insight as to human beings at their lowest moment.
So when I was in law enforcement, I was a firearms trainer. I was state certified. So at times I was working with new jailers or patrol officers. Yeah. And when you talk about violent behavior from being on patrol standpoint, you have to realize when you approach these people, whether it be a traffic stop, a call to their house, you're responding to a domestic violence, or you're doing a welfare check. I mean, the people that make the decision to use deadly force on other people or just force in general, they are at a point in their life where they feel like they have nothing left to lose. But the truth is they have a lot to lose, because in our state, being a death penalty state, depending on what they do, ultimately that could be the most severe punishment handed down to them. I mean, in addition to loss of freedom, maybe even for the rest of their life. How do you end up in the position where you think you've lost everything you have? You know, I think some of this goes back to at home, growing up in a family. And I realize in our state, I can say things like this. You know, a lot of it starts at home with going to church with your kids and being involved in their activities, whether it be at school or 4-H or Boy Scouts or the church youth group or whatever is going on with your family or the marching band or other activities. But, you know, nationwide, I don't know, and I don't honestly think that takes place. Mm. As you talk about more urban centers like New York City, Las Vegas, Los Angeles, and I hate to say it, Minneapolis and Omaha, you know, they are far removed from the rural roots that we come from. And they may not have those values that were instilled in them by their parents and their grandparents. I hope I answered the question.
Yeah, there's a lot to think about.
Really
there.
Complicated.
Matt Schluter is a former law enforcement officer and owner of Schluter Firearms Instruction. You can find all our SDPB Spotlight coverage on guns in South Dakota on our website at sdpb.org/spotlight. We also want to hear your stories. Call us at 605-951-0740. That's where you can leave a message about one of your formative memories about firearms. Well, we are finally looking at some 60-degree days in western South Dakota starting on Sunday. That comes with a chance of light rain on Monday. Highs near 50 on Saturday in north-central South Dakota. Mostly cloudy and near 60 on Sunday, where the 45th Mobridge Art show is going on both days from noon to 5. It's taking place at the Cher Howe Arena. Hobby Earth Day is a live music and craft beer festival. It's this Saturday from 2 to 5 at Drifter's Bar and Grill in Pier. Music is from the Black River Review. Go to driftersbarandgrill.com for more information and to check on any COVID updates. Should be partly sunny and 50 the day of the event. Central South Dakota should enjoy highs in the upper 60s on Sunday. The Sioux Falls Skedaddle is a half marathon organized by 605 Running Company. It's scheduled for Sunday from 7 to noon, highs in the mid-60s on Sunday in the southeast. There could be some rain showers. And finally, the South Dakota State football team opens their playoff season with a first-round game against Holy Cross. It'll be sunny and cool with a high in the mid to upper 40s for the 2 o'clock kickoff at Dana Dykehouse Stadium in Brookings. Check our SDPB events calendar for events going on across the state. We're at sdpb.org. Coming up next on The Moment, a conversation with today's Morning Philip guest, Steve Long. He's president and CEO of Hancock Health in Indiana. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Sometimes when people get sick with this disease, they can't get back to work for a really, really long time.
COVID long haulers appear to represent the largest influx of new entrants to the American disability community that we've seen in modern history.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, our old disability system dealing with a new crisis. Next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Humanities Council, celebrating literature, promoting civil conversation, and telling the stories that define our state. Learn more at sdhumanities.org.
Hi, this is Carol Johnson. If you made a gift to SDPB during the Sound Vision Drive, my husband Al and I thank you. We were thrilled to offer a matching gift to help SDPB continue its mission. We want SDPB to be all that it can be for South Dakota. Haven't made a gift yet? There's still time to give. Please go online at sdpb.org/donate. Thank you very much.
Program funding is provided by Sanford Underground Research Facility, hosting world-leading research in physics and other disciplines. Learn more about America's Underground Science Laboratory at sanfordlab.org.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, perhaps never before have we paid such close attention to healthcare for such an extended period of time. Our next guest lives this environment and was speaking about it this morning during the NUMAD Group's virtual Morning Philip gathering, sponsored in part by the Bush Foundation. Steve Long is the president and CEO of Hancock Health and Hancock Regional Hospital in Greenfield, Indiana, and he joins us now on the phone. Steve Long, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here in the program,
well,
in the moment.
Thanks. It is great to be with you guys.
Let's talk a little bit about what we have learned during this pandemic, as all eyes have been on things like public health and the cost of healthcare. And one thing we all know for sure is that healthcare is incredibly expensive. Tell me a little bit about that in context first, please.
Oh, absolutely. And I couldn't agree more. Even though I am the president of a hospital, I would be the first to say that healthcare really is too expensive, especially here in America. You know, we spend more per capita on healthcare than any other country in the world. And in fact, it's approaching $4 trillion a year that we spend on healthcare right here in our own country. And in the last couple of years, we became the largest employer with 11 of the fastest growing jobs in any industry being right inside of healthcare. And it makes me wonder that it's whether it's really sustainable for the long term.
Why has it become the largest employer when we look at our gross national product, and our gross domestic product, and the things that we do as a nation? Why is all of a sudden healthcare becoming the largest employer in so many areas?
Well, you know, there are many reasons for that. Let me put one little thing in context. Is when we say $4 trillion on healthcare, that's one out of every $20 spent on anything in the entire world. So that gives you some context to it. So I think that there are a few core reasons why we are the largest employer, why it's so expensive. One is that we have an insurance-focused marketplace. You know, you really can't access healthcare unless you have insurance. And our insurance is provided by and large through our employers or through the government, and it's very heavily subsidized. So that goes into it. I think also healthcare is a very hands-on approach. You know, it's not something that you can really outsource or globalize like so many other industries. And it is very labor intensive. You know, for every physician, there are six clinical support people like nurses or nurse practitioners or PAs or medical assistants. But in addition to that, there are 10 administrative people per doctor in America because it is so administratively complex. And then you add on to that that the population is aging. But I think the single biggest reason is that we have a chronic disease epidemic. You know, we talk about the COVID pandemic. We've had a different epidemic for quite a long time, and it's really all about chronic disease like diabetes and heart disease and lung disease and some cancers. So that I think really is at the core of it.
So we have some people who are insured, but still, even though you might have good insurance, a lot of your expendable income goes to pay for anything that you have to have done. And then we have thousands of people in South Dakota who have no insurance at all and therefore don't go to the doctor to get things taken care of. And now add this to the fact that all the COVID long haulers are entering this new world of having chronic disease that they didn't have before. We know the problem. What are some of the solutions? What are some of the things you're trying to do at Hancock and with your colleagues to say, we can do this better?
Absolutely. Well, you know, first of all I would say that here in Indiana, we're very fortunate that we did the Medicaid expansion many years ago. And so that has really helped us with those folks in the lower incomes that have difficulty accessing health care. So that I think was a big thing for us. But the things that we're particularly doing in our health system, number one, we understand that chronic disease is such a problem, and especially the long haulers that you're talking about. I mean, there are consequences that we don't even know about yet, but these will be chronic diseases. So we're changing the way we interact with those folks. So we actually send people into a patient's home to understand their living environment and understand their social circumstances, because social determinants of health really drive what our health status is going to be. We also understand that chronic disease is really very preventable. And I think that's a lesson that we learned from COVID. You know, we didn't have any great treatments for COVID. The very best thing you could do was prevent it. And that was wearing the mask and washing our hands and keeping our distance. So those preventive behaviors are really what made a difference. And we are understanding that chronic disease is really driven by the choices that we all make. And so we need to be living in an environment that nudges us into making healthier choices. And we can do that. We're actually doing that here in Hancock County with things like food as medicine programs and wellness centers. And we have a trail system that's actually inside of the county comprehensive plan. So we just understand also that we're not just our physical nature. We're mind, body, spirit together. So we have programs around that as well. And then finally, you know, we all do the things that we are financially incentivized to do. And so we're trying to change our incentives away from being a system that really provides treatment to people after they get sick to one where we're incentivized to provide preventive care to keep people from getting sick in the first place. Those are the kind of things that I think we need to do nationally. We're doing some of that here in Indiana. And I think that there are some great things happening in South Dakota as well.
South Dakota did not choose to do Medicaid expansion. Why should we?
Well, you know, it is one of those things where in Indiana, we're also a very conservative state, and we took the tack of saying that hospitals understood how important it was, so we helped the state government actually fund that Medicaid expansion. So I think that was a big part of doing that here. We also understood that there are some pretty huge disparities in health outcomes between different folks in our communities, and we tend to have some very diverse populations here. We thought that that was probably the best way for us to address some of that. So we just, as a state, highlighted the importance of getting access to health care to everybody. Because, you know, at the end of the day, and you mentioned it earlier, if a person doesn't seek health care when they first become sick or seek preventive care, they're going to become very sick and they will end up in the hospital in the emergency room. And at that point, it's the hospitals that are paying the bill. So hospitals have an incentive to try to make sure that folks are covered. So I'm certainly hopeful that South Dakota considers that as well.
Steve Long is president and CEO of Hancock Health and Hancock Regional Hospital in Greenfield, Indiana, and he was the speaker for this morning's virtual gathering of Morning Philip that is brought to you by the NewMed Group and the Bush Foundation based in Rapid City. Thanks so much, Steve Long. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
Well, it is a good sign when South Dakota Home Garden returns to In the Moment. It means that we're talking about planting, growing, and getting out and enjoying your surroundings, even if that's just in your backyard. If you have questions for Eric Helland about South Dakota Home Garden and your gardening and growing questions, you send us an email, inthemoment@sdpb.org. Today, we're going to start by talking about bare root plants. So imagine instead of having a bucket filled with dirt that you've brought home from the landscape center, you're holding that intricate root system in your hands and getting ready to place it in the earth. Eric Helland is president and CEO of Landscape Garden Centers in Sioux Falls, and he joins us for our kickoff of South Dakota Home Garden. Eric, welcome back. Nice to hear you.
Hey, Lori, how have you been?
I've been just fine looking out that window at the buds starting to pop on the lilacs and thinking about digging in the earth. So let's start with bare root plants. You can go in and see them from tip to tail. How does this work at a landscape center?
Okay, so bare root, the bare root cellar or root cellars have been around for hundreds of years. Basically goes back to preserving rooted vegetables, like potatoes and carrots and turnips and things like that. And so then as time goes on, places needed how would you preserve plant material and be able to transport dormant plant material that's basically sleeping throughout the whole United States in a fashion that's good for the plants, less expensive, and things like that. So that's been passed on to an independent garden center like ourselves. And the awesome thing about it is you get to see what you're buying from, like you said, from head to toe. The roots are exposed. Therefore, we call them bare root. They are sleeping, so you get to see the root system, the trunk, all the way up to the top. You'll see the buds, and once you plant them in the ground, they'll wake up with everything else.
Yeah, it seems like a great activity to do if you're planting something with kids. They can really see, and it's a great science lesson there and a great thing to do as a family. What are you looking for when you select something? Once you can see the full plant, how do you tell between healthy and maybe pass on this one?
Right. So, the root system that you see in a root cellar, you'll see about 200% more roots, or a tree or a plant will have 200% more roots on that plant than if you were to buy it in a container. The container, all the roots have been trimmed off and cut in it, and put into this container. So you're getting all of the root system. You see the fibrous roots, and that's really the main thing. The top of it really doesn't matter at this point because these plants are still very young. These plants are probably anywhere from, 1 to 5 years old. They have been grafted to a root stock that is hardy for the particular area. Fruit trees are very, very popular, and this is the best way to start up your little orchard or want a couple apple trees or peach trees that are hardy for our area, even apricot.
Huh. All right. How do you plant that in the earth? How deep do you go then once you see, the roots and the graft place and how do you put it in the ground?
Yeah, so great question. So make sure you call for utilities. You're not going to be planting the plant or the tree in an area that there will be a lot of standing water. Make sure it's in well-drained soil. Typically, the bare root trees need a wider hole than they need deeper. They're usually only about less than a foot or 18 inches deep, and they'll be a little bit wider, and then just loosen up the soil, and then you'll plant it as deep we call it a root flare. And I think we just did a video on that, of where that root flare is, that's on your website. And that will show you exactly where, that's kind of basically where you want the top of the tree, the top of the root system to be, just barely below the ground. And once you plant it in there, make sure you tamp it in really well so it's straight. And then water it in, and then watch it grow and water it, you know, as the, once the top couple inches of the soil become dry, then water it in again.
All right. Can I do that? You know, the other day I woke up to a dusting of snow. So do you have to wait to a certain point to put things in the ground, or is now the time?
Yeah, so that was, you did not see snow. That was just a figment of your imagination.
Good.
Yeah, so now is the best time. And the weather that we are having right now is awesome for bare root plant material, because it's still cool out. The ground temperatures are very cool. And it looks as though even next week, going into this next week is the last week of April, that's cool. So that's, it's seriously, we should be able to keep that root cellar open for maybe a couple weeks into May.
Nice. All right. Anything else? Now, don't forget, everybody, call before you dig. That's our, your first public service announcement. And one more question that I have for you, Eric, is some people are saying, you know, the pollinators, the bees that are still kind of, is it time to clean out the leaves from your flower bed, or should you wait a little bit longer to let pollinators finish their hibernation? What do you know about when is it time to clean up your yard from the debris of winter?
So if you have time to clean it up, clean it up. There's not an exact science of when to clean it up. Just go out there and clean it up when it's nice out and it's, the weather's conducive. And it's just, I mean, get out there and clean it up. Right now is a great time. Just get it done.
So you mean I'm making an excuse to procrastinate because of the bees, and really you're going to be like my dad and say, just go do it?
Sorry, I didn't hear the wink wink on that one. No. Yeah, there,
but the bees, today. Eric. The couple bees? More weeks,
yeah.
For the bees.
No, there's still bees out there right now.
All right. Eric Helen, thank you so much. Welcome back and happy spring.
Thank you, Lori. Have a great day.
All right, we've got several ways you can connect with our South Dakota Home Garden feature. Tune into In the Moment on Thursdays. Ask your questions as I talk with Eric Helen. You can also go online to sdpb.org/sdhomegarden. And that's where you're going to find videos and social media links, printable information, diagrams of gardening and growing topics. You can also watch our South Dakota Home Garden Video of the Week on SDPB TV1. It's a 5-minute program that airs Thursdays right after Frankie Drake Mysteries, Saturdays after Carol Burnett, and again after Father Brown, Sundays after Midsummer Murders. South Dakota Home Garden is made possible by McCrory Gardens, and our guest has been Eric Helland. He is president and CEO of Landscape Garden Centers in Sioux Falls.